Welcome to the Back Ass Words podcast. We are the Back Ass Words boys. I'm Kyle. I use he, they pronouns. And joining me from our beautiful Colorado studio is Arden.
And I use he, him pronouns.
Tonight, guys, gals, and NB pals, I am going to be hitting the probably the midpoint of our series on the Dyatlov Pass with part two, theories, part one.
And let me just say really quick from the co-host perspective that I walked into tonight's episode with Kyle being like, okay, so when I put all of my research into a document, it was 70 pages long.
It was 80 pages.
So this is now a three-part series. And I was like, okay, that's what we're doing. And honestly, I'm so excited because not only did we talk about Dyatlov last, well, not last week, but 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. we started our Dyatlov series. And not only was that episode fascinating, but what you folks don't know is that off air, Kyle assigned me homework, which I did not do until 45 minutes before class.
We did it together.
We did it together. And we watched Fear of Cold by, what's the guy on YouTube again?
Jacob Geller.
Jacob Geller, yes. And this video essay mm-hmm. was absolutely incredible. It was so well done. It was so well put together. And
I highly recommend him.
It very much talks about the scenario that these people are in. It doesn't actually directly address Dyatlov in Fear of Cold.
Yeah, which kind of surprised me, honestly.
It surprised me too, but this is definitely a video in the vernacular of what we're talking about. Highly, highly recommend it. I think it really sets the tone for what this series really is in totality.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we are actually going to be kind of doing a tangentially related topic on our sideshow for our Patreon subscribers, the Wednesday Phenomena this
the
week.
The Wednesday Phenomena!
I am going to be reading you the short story To Build a Fire by Jack London.
Yes.
It's an old classic. It's also very tangentially related to what we're talking about on the main show here. So if you want to hear my amazing voice, yes, narrate that for you. I'm assuming I'm reading it. We actually haven't talked about it.
I think that it's great if
you can absolutely read it if you want. Oh my god. We might split it up. Who knows? We'll figure it out off air.
Oh god. That's so funny.
Man, I'm such an egotistical asshole. No, holy shit. Okay.
Kyle. Stop. Don't say that about my friend.
But somebody is going to be reading that story on the Wednesday Phenomena this week. So if you want to hear that, go ahead and subscribe at $5 and become a Manchurian candidate. It really helps us out. We have a ton of fun and we'll shout you out on the podcast.
Dude, it is really so funny to me how MK Ultra is the beating heartbeat of this podcast. Literally our $5 subscribers are called Manchurian candidates.
Oh yeah.
It's so good.
It was on purpose. Absolutely.
It was on purpose. It's great. I love it.
So, guys, before we get into it, we are going to list our sources. And, of course, the first stop on the research train was our good friend, Wikipedia.
Because, in case you have forgotten, my friends, we stan Wikipedia on this motherfucking podcast.
Thank God we do.
Oh, my word.
I used their page on the Dyatlov Pass incident. I also used an article from abc.net titled Dyatlov Pass Mystery Potentially Solved. And I want to give the biggest shout out this week specifically to dyatlovpass.com and their theories page. A good chunk of my research is coming, coming from that page this week.
Perfect. Absolutely perfect.
Huge shout out to them. They've done fantastic work. Go support them. Go check them out for sure. But you guys, despite listing our sources and sending our listeners to them, we are not scholars.
Nope.
And we are probably going to get some things wrong.
like what happened during the Dyatlov Pass incident.
Almost certainly. Definitely this week. And we are also not linguists, so we are probably going to say some things wrong.
There's a lot of Russian, and we could also potentially misspeak on what happened during the Dyatlov Pass incident.
We are going to be butchering these names, my friends. I am so sorry. Or my comrades, I guess I should say.
I did watch a video called Fear of Cold, but we are in no way scientists.
Yeah, we are. No. Absolutely not. But get it? Hold on to your asses.
Kyle, you kill me.
Because things are about to get backwards.
Kyle, I'm so excited. This is now at least a three-part series, and I'm so here for it. Take us into it. We're so... You know, I said this last time. I said we're so ready last time we did Dyatlov, and you said, no, you're not. And it was true then. So, I'm not going to say that, but we are ready.
Hell yeah. This episode is going to be a lot of bullet points. We're going to be going through a lot of different theories. So, we're going to dive in head first, all right? And we're going to start off with one of the most widely cited and widely proclaimed explanations, and one that I absolutely do not buy into for a split fucking second.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is the Lee Harvey Oswald did it alone of
oh god
of the Dyatlov Pass.
Yeah, okay, all right.
And that is the theory of an avalanche, specifically a snow slab avalanche occurring to the crew.
Okay.
And the biggest problem with this theory is that this area of the mountain specifically is not an avalanche prone area. The mountain is not all that tall and certainly is not very steep. And furthermore, the opponents of this theory suggest that hikers' diaries report a very thin snow cover. However, these facts don't exclude the possibility of a very small avalanche occurring. A portion of the upper layer of snow could simply shift and roll over the hikers in what is known as a slab avalanche, where the entire surface of the snow shifts as one piece, right?
Horrifying circumstance, I'll say.
Oh, yeah. And this could explain the damage to the tent and create havoc among the hikers, who would suddenly be trapped underneath several feet of snow. It would certainly explain why the tent was cut from the inside. And further retreat would be necessary if the hikers were worried that a second avalanche could strike again. According to the supporters of this theory, the Dyatlov group tried to make their way back to the Ospaya River and instead made a fatal mistake by descending into the valley of the Lozva River. After 4 weeks, the snow that was rushed down the slope of the mountain was simply blown off by the strong winds that are common in the region. And this would erase all signs of the natural disaster. But this theory has its gaps.
I'll say so.
From what we can tell, the footprints left by the group seemed to descend with relative ease. And it is highly unlikely that the three people with broken ribs and a frail chest would be transportable at all. Not to mention that the snow blew off the tent but didn't blow away their footprints.
Also, come on. Yeah, for real. But also, I don't understand how that explains the tent being cut from the inside. Like,
if they were trapped under the snow,
I mean,
they could have still used the zipper.
I mean, they could have still used the zipper.
They could have still used the zipper.
They also still could have used the tent, Kyle. You understand exactly what I'm saying here? Like, what the fuck are we talking about?
Because again, we aren't talking about a little tiny two-person backpacking tent. We're talking about a 10-person big 8-foot-tall tent. This is a tent, capital T. This isn't a little tent.
I'm sorry. I wasn't a Boy Scout. Is there a gap in my knowledge? Would I not just stay in the tent?
I mean, it depends on how badly it was damaged and how much snow was on top of you, right?
Right.
Because if it had kind of created a little crevice that the tent was still mostly upright in, I might consider staying in the tent, at least until we can form a game plan, you know?
Right. And go down by the river.
Yeah.
Huh. I guess it's the circumstance. It's a circumstantial thing, a case by case basis, if you will.
A little bit.
Hmm. Okay. All right. All right.
But to speak to what you were talking about, Arden, the second point that kind of detracts from this is that these people were very well trained.
Right.
They knew their chances of freezing to death were far more likely than getting killed by a second avalanche. Although the removal of the damaged tent from an exposed mountainside was out of the question, they had to retrieve all of their warm clothes and footwear. And finally, why would experienced hikers retreat calmly in order, all clustered together directly along the path of the alleged avalanche?
Yeah, good point.
In a scientific paper, a Swiss avalanche theory ambassador said that they actually saw an avalanche on Death Mountain. And to their credit, this is true. Only that the spot is well known to everybody who has ever gone to the Dyatlov Pass, winter or summer, because the spot in question, the snow never thaws completely there, and the place wasn't investigated directly because it is 3 kilometers away from the tent and has completely different weather conditions. Although avalanches can fall on this particular spot, it has nothing with what happened to do with the Dyatlov group. And also, if you look at some of the pictures from the rescue group, on the right, you can see part of the hiker's gear that is kept in its vertical position on the slope weeks after the tragedy. If their hiking poles were able to stand up, how is a tent getting knocked over?
Right. That's what I'm saying. I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh because I know it's such a serious subject matter, but like, come on.
And furthermore, the entrance of the tent is clearly elevated. Only the middle portion of the collapse was probably due to hasty escape or the weight of snow that had simply accumulated there.
Right, just like regular wheeling and dealing snow that just fall from correct. The sky.
Which is basically to say the tent hadn't necessarily collapsed while they were in it. Maybe a little bit, but not to the extent that it was when the group found it, right?
Yeah, it also is a really good point that you made there with, like, why, if an avalanche just happened, are they walking along the path of this fucking avalanche? You know what I mean? It doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. All right, for this next one, I'm going to put on my professor hat a little bit, my actual professor hat.
Oh.
Not my fun professor hat. We're going to get scientific for a minute here, so bear with me. This is another very, very commonly cited theory in the Dyatlov incident, and that is katabitic wind. Katabitic wind derives its name from the Greek word katabasis, which means descending. Mm. This type of falling wind can appear when cold air over a glacier or a mountainous area starts to flow down a gradient. This phenomenon can be described as a ball rolling downhill forced by gravity. So it is also labeled as gravity wind. In layman's super easy terms, it's a wind that carries high density air from a higher low density air on the top of the slope down into low density air on the bottom of the slope, right? So think of it as a pocket of low density air moving very, very quickly down the side of a mountain. We're okay. Talking about like up to 20 meters a second.
Okay.
Or 60 feet per second.
That's crazy. That's fast.
Oh, yeah. Since cooled air has a higher density than the surrounding atmosphere, katabitic wind can sometimes accelerate to the force of a hurricane. The strongest of these winds are usually found on drops surrounding mighty ice sheets, but can also occur on cooled mountain areas similar to the topography of Dyatlov Pass. A similar landscape to the mountains of South Orten can, for example, be found in Sweden, in the rolling terrain of Arnis. In February of 1978, damned cooled air was put in motion very quickly with devastating consequences for a group of 9 skiers. The group of 2 women and 7 men were overtaken by wind speeds at least 20 meters a second, an explosive scenario that erupted out of a rather calm and pleasant skiing tour. Only one of them survived. This is after being found far away from the temporary and insufficient snow shelter made by the core group. A Swedish wind record for such wind is up to 81 meters per second, which was documented in 1992 at the Trafalla Research Station. In this case, we aren't even talking about an ice sheet over Antarctica, where such winds are normally considered even stronger than the ones measured in Swedish wind records. A cataclysmic wind could initiate when cold air on top of a higher point begins to fall downhill, displacing warmer air below it. If the lower elevations are comparatively much lower, the stronger the wind. In most places where the phenomena appears, it usually does so at night when the temperature is rapidly dropping. An interesting note in the Dyatlov Group diary, made a short period of time before the accident, described a relatively warm wind compared to that of a jet engine. The wind was blowing from the valleys below under a clear blue sky. This could have potentially laid the foundation for the unfortunate events that unfolded between the 1st and 2nd of February in 1959. What is important to realize regarding falling winds is that these appear quickly as opposed to something like a storm. A storm gives you time to dress and secure or dismantle a tent properly. Tents are not built for extreme winds that would rather swiftly tear it to pieces. In the case of the Dyatlov group, the only survivable scenario would have been to run out, conceal the tent, and wait out the ordeal elsewhere, later to then rebuild the buried equipment. If the event was to continue for a longer time, or if it was outside, or if the outside temperature was far too low, the consequence would be deadly without suitable shelters or helping hands. And, hypothetically speaking, one way to save the tent from blowing away would be to cover it with something nearby that is very heavy, like snow.
No. They picked the snow up. That's what this is saying.
Mm-hmm. In fact, they would have collapsed the tent themselves to reduce the chances of wind damage, followed by a shielding of the snow on top to hold the tent down. In the event of a catabatic wind, the Dyatlov team would have actually been acting successfully and skillfully by shadowing the steps above. This could in fact explain why the tent was located with a protective snow cover and a flashlight that likely would have been used as a beacon for relocating the position of the tent later.
They're so smart. These people are so smart.
Oh yeah. And in the photos taken by the rescue team, clear traces of snow reflected by strong wind can be seen pointing towards the tent from the peak of the mountain. The actual pattern demonstrates heavily wind-swept snow where the vortexes had hollowed out scoop-shaped cavities. And this brings us to another slightly related to the catabatic wind. That would be something called infrasound. I think we may have briefly mentioned infrasound on the show before.
I do not remember talking about it, but it's very possible.
It would have been back during number stations.
Mm. Yeah, even I can't access those memories.
So one theory is that infrasound may have been responsible for sudden unpleasant feelings between the hikers. New research into rare weather phenomena has suggested that a perfect storm could have struck the campers in the night, panicking them so much that they would have fled the tent and fallen victim to the brutal cold before they came to their senses. Donnie Eicher, who spent 5 years researching the incident and undertook the dangerous trek himself, believes that a wind phenomena called a Karman vortex sheet could have produced a terrifying, powerful sound which is proven to induce irrational fear in humans. Due to the unique topography, Dead Mountain, which is a perfect dome shape, and the fierce winds that blow through the pass could have been warped as they struck through the blunt surface. The wind, which was blowing in a straight line, would be twisted into a series of small but powerful tornado-like features which would tear down either side of the pass.
What?
The tornadoes, spinning fast enough to tear the roofs off of buildings, would have created a deafening noise, even if they missed the tents, as Eicher's theory suggests. But under certain circumstances, they could also produce a more subtle and terrifying phenomena known as infrasound. The opposite of ultrasound, infrasound is a type of vibration in the air which has a frequency so low that it cannot be picked up by the human ear. But a series of studies has shown that it can have marked effects on the human body and psychology, including loss of sleep, shortness of breath, and an extreme feeling of dread. Eicher, backed by scientists at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the United States, believes that the combination of the effects on infrasound, the deafening noise of the tornadoes, and the claustrophobic, pitch-black tent could unseat even the most steady-minded adventurer. Though the science sounds incredible, Eicher believes it is the only logical explanation for the situation in which the bodies were found. Although Dyatlov Pass is so remote and inaccessible that the weather phenomena cannot be directly observed there in the winter, it has been observed in similarly shaped locations, including the Rock of Gibraltar and various other mountain peaks. Now, Arden, for this one, we might need to just a little bit.
Put on the tinfoil hat, Professor.
Just a little bit for this one.
I thought you said the fun professor wasn't coming out.
Oh, he's back. He's taking over the second round of class.
Well, I mean,
Second period.
The other professor is blowing my mind, so I could definitely use fun Professor Kyle for a second.
Well, Arden, Russian scientists believe that the hikers came to an area where, under certain circumstances, the forces of gravity can fluctuate.
Oh my god, of course. Of course, why didn't I think of this?
Of course.
Oh god.
St. Petersburg physicist, doctor, associate professor of the Institute of Engineering, and holder of more than 100 patents, German Erichno, believes that the significantly decreased external pressure threw hikers out of the tent.
Of course! Of course! Why didn't I think of this?
Scientists have long studied thermodynamics, hydrodynamics, and various aspects of the nature of gravity and the weightlessness of bodies. And Dr. Erichno believes that the Dyatlov group came to an area where at the confluence of circumstances could have significantly decreased the forces of gravity. Dr. Erichno said, quote,
"It formed a corridor of a kind in which Earth's gravity decreased. The hikers in the tent, sleeping or just getting ready, had time to undress. And then unknown force began to lift them off of the floor and drag them into the direction of the corridor. As the outside air pressure was significantly lower than inside the tent, people began to push outwards. The emerging hikers instantly pushed the tent from the inside, and since the pressure in their bodies still remained high, they received unexplained internal injuries, including broken bones."
Yeah, do you ever think that maybe they just fell into a gravity well and that broke their bones?
Of course! Of course, of course, of course. Dude, I am absolutely floored. But what an accusation. What a hefty claim.
Oh, it gets heftier, Arden.
Oh, no.
He claims that some of the hikers would have died instantly and others would have remained alive for some time. But the bodies, once outside of the tent, would have remained hovering in the air as though laying on a horizontal surface. In this position, the same force would have pulled them to the side. And according to Erichno's calculation, This phenomenon would have lasted for a few minutes.
What?
Meaning that this could have thrown them up to a kilometer and a half. They may have flown one by one or in groups of two or three from the tent to scatter on the slope and into the woods. When they were falling in the snow from a height, not being able to protect themselves, they would have received the injuries on their faces, which became disfigured, losing their tongues. The physicist said that if the hikers did not get out of the firmly fixed onto the ground tent, they may not have actually died. In addition, according to this scientist, such events are not uncommon in the area.
What?
People, cattle, and wild animals are known to die in a similar manner with alarming regularity. He said, quote,
"For those in the future who will go visit Dyatlov Pass, it is worth bearing in mind that the corridor where the gravity to Earth is decreased can open again. Hunters in the area often go into the woods, and the big question, why is this happening in this place, needs yet to be surveyed and answered."
That is the big question.
That is the big question, isn't it? Why didn't I think of that? Here's the thing, dude. I'm just going to say it right now. I know that we're rapid firing these theories. This right. one is fucking crazy. This one is wild.
Yeah.
This one is so not true.
Well, let's get into one that's a little bit more grounded, Arden.
A little bit more grounded, huh?
Yeah, let's talk about the Menk.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to laugh.
The Menk is the indigenous Monsi people's term for what we in the West would call a Yeti.
Ah, snow cones.
Yeah. The Discovery Channel documentary, documentary, Russian Yeti, The Killer Lives, caps a marathon of Discovery monster hoaxes, such as the Megalodon hoax or their mermaid documentary. And it was really like the capstone of this series that they made.
Okay.
In this program, hosts Mike Lebrecki and Maria Klinova set out to solve the Dyatlov Pass incident, or rather, to pretend on air that it had something to do with a Yeti. And tragic, plausible scenarios, as we are explaining here, were in ready supply. They just do not make good television. The central showpiece of the program was a black and white still photograph showing a dark, unidentified figure standing in the trees. It is introduced with stark on-screen text saying, "The following image is one of the last photos taken by the hikers. It is being shown on television for the first time."
Yo!
The picture is presented as evidence that a Yeti was stalking the doomed party through the woods for several days, and they caught the inhuman killer on film. So what are we to make of this extraordinary photographic evidence? Well, to begin with, it doesn't look like a Yeti. You know what it looks like?
What does it look like, Kyle? You know, I'm sitting here, and I've been sitting here, and I have been sitting here, and I have been wondering and wondering and wondering. What am I to make of this extraordinary photographic evidence that they seem to collect?
Arden, I'm so glad you asked.
I said it wrong. I said it wrong. What does it look like, Kyle?
It looks like someone took a picture of their friend standing in the trees.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
But they tried to sell it on this TV program, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Look at this.
In fact, they leave us very few chances to choose any other more cynical possibilities.
It's kind of like how we said in our documentary episode last week, every documentary has an agenda, is trying to tell you something or convince you of something or enlighten you to something.
Exactly.
Except they all feign themselves as we're trying to enlighten you. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. And now we're going to take the tinfoil hat off. We're going to go back to reality a little bit here.
The not so
I know, fun. I know. It's not going away. It's not going away.
It'll come back.
It's coming back on. Don't worry. It's coming back on. Clark Wilkins, in his book, A Compelling Known Force, The Dyatlov Pass Incident, a.k.a. 6 Hours to Live.
What a title.
It's a good one.
Satanic Astronomy.
This book promotes the theory that the hikers left the tent due to smoke from the stove. The problem with this theory, of course, is that they wouldn't have to go a mile down the hill to escape the smoke from the tent. And even if they thought it could be a fire in the tent, they wouldn't need to go so far from it and would likely want to save the tent. They could easily put it down with plenty of snow laying around, and it easily would have been remedied by opening the tent and ventilating the air.
Right.
They certainly wouldn't completely abandon the tent without their shoes and coats. Another weakness of the theory is that the consistency of reports by witnesses and investigators that the stove was not assembled and still in its carrying case.
So weird.
Let's say it's bullshit. Theory.
I mean, obviously, if the stove is not even out of the box, it's still in the box.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Because, like, in the
what's in the box? It's a stove.
It's a stove. Finally, we have an answer. Here's the thing: is like we watched Fear of Cold right before we recorded this episode, right? And there was that story of that guy who was living in Antarctica and his stove was like poisoning him. So, yeah. Like. When you first brought this up, I was like, ooh, interesting, because like that is something that would happen, right? But it doesn't sound like that's what happened with this one, because the what's in the box? The stove.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I don't think so. Oh, here we
Manita go. Manita Muscarium.
Here we go. This could be possible.
Amanita muscaria mushrooms are highly toxic, but they become less lethal when dried out. Conveniently, they grow most commonly under pine trees because their spores travel exclusively on pine seeds.
I think this is bad if you find yourself in a forest.
Shaman would also often hang them on the lower branches of pine trees that they were growing under to dry out before taking them back to their village. As an alternative, they would put them in a sock and hang them over the fire to dry. This is where Christmas socks come from.
Ah.
Uh-huh.
Ah.
Another way to remove the fatal toxins from the shrooms was to feed them to reindeer who would get high from them and then pee with their digestive systems having filtered out most of the toxins, making the urine safe for humans to drink and get a high much safer that way.
Yo, we were just doing shit to just not fucking deal with it, huh?
Well, reindeer love Amanita muscaria and will eat them whenever they can. So a good supply of magic pee was usually ready and waiting for all winter. In fact, reindeer like the fly Arnak so much that they would eat any snow where a human who had drank shroom-laced urine had then peed, and then the circle would continue.
Yo.
Yeah.
They're getting high off our pee. We're getting high off their pee. It's the circle of life. It's exactly.
I found that out, and I had to include it. I couldn't not share that information.
Dude, the Lion King was right. It really is a circle of life. Oh, my God.
When the shaman would go out to gather the mushrooms, he would wear a red outfit with either white trim or white dots to honor the mushroom's colors. And because at that time of year, the whole region was usually covered in deep snow, he, like everyone else, would wear tall boots of reindeer skin that would then be blackened from exposure. He'd gather the tree-dyed fly arnak and some reindeer urine in a large sack and then return home to his yurt, the traditional form of housing for people in the region at the time, where some of the higher-ups of the village would have gathered to join in the solstice ceremony.
So, Santa Claus.
Santa killed the DLF Pass group.
Oh my god. Gave them fucking magic reindeer pee, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Dude, I and also just really quick before we get into this next theory, why am I, every single time we talk about Fly a Garrick, I'm reminded that Toad from the Mario Kingdom is Fly a Garrick mushroom, dude.
Yeah.
And all of the mushrooms that he eats are Fly a Garrick.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
So the theory here is that, I just included the Santa bit because I found that during my research, and right. I had to share the info. We didn't get it in the Santa episode, so
we didn't. This is true. I failed
Santa you part both. Three.
Yeah, in this regard, I failed you.
But the idea being that the group may have ingested the mushrooms either intentionally or unintentionally and suffered a delirium and sweating with acute doses. This would account for what appears to be the bizarre behavior of the group on that final night.
See, like, this one is almost, like, plausible to me because, like, the tent being cut from allegedly the inside is the weirdest part of this case to me. I will say
this. Yeah, but if they were all tripping sack?
Correct.
Totally makes sense. That logic makes absolute sense. I got to get out of this tent right now. I'm getting my way out.
Yes.
There's no doors.
Exactly. Especially because it's Fly a Garrick, too. So, like, I think...
That's not a fun trip, to be super clear.
No, it's not the kind of mushrooms that you want to take.
No.
But it's plausible, but I find it hard to believe on both sides of it.
Yeah.
The more likely scenario to me is that they accidentally ingested it. But I find it hard to believe that this group of extremely capable and experienced people accidentally ate Fly a Garrick. Like, if it is this common, and if it is so what it is, right?
Oh, they would know. They would know. They were naturalists. They would know the plants that commonly grew in their in the areas they hiked in. And they would know about Amanita muscaria, 100%.
100%. And so if they intentionally ate it, I also find this hard to believe because they're so experienced and smart. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't want to eat these mushrooms. So
You want to drink
the reindeer pee. You don't want to eat the mushroom straight. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And Dyatlov, the leader of the group, like literally reprimanded one of the members for bringing a flask on the trip and was like, hey, we need to be sober for this. This is serious. So I don't think they would have purposefully ingested them. And I don't see a scenario where they would have accidentally ingested them. It would explain their behavior, but I don't see a scenario where they get to that point.
It's hard for me on that one, dude, because it does explain it, but hard to believe. Oh, excuse me. Let me just notify the audience that the tinfoil hat has come back on. I'm looking at it on Professor Kyle's head right now.
The author of the video, They Aged on the Pass, claims that they look 40 to 50 years old in the photos before they died, except for Xena, because the horror for some reason didn't affect her. The author of the video consistently says that there are photos he doesn't want to show because they are too horrific. He's reminding us to watch his previous and next episodes for more details, saying that there are artifacts that only he can see in the background of these photos, but in general, pacing himself, saying to watch the next episode. Constantly watch the next episode. There's never anything in the next episode.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm...
to be clear. The author even claims to see, like, monsters in the wood and thinks the searchers are looking for the monsters, not the Dyatlov group. He also cites the same Yeti picture as a source for this information.
Okay.
The author of the video says that he is in possession of information about what the rock or obelisk in some of the photos is, but he isn't just going to tell us. He calls blotches on photos UFOs. He shows photos of the hikers, suggesting that we haven't seen these people, even though they're definitely members of the group. Basically, just be careful when you're researching the Dyatlov Pass incident.
Yeah.
This case specifically really attracts people that have... lost the plot a little bit, let's say.
Yeah. It definitely seems like it. And I mean, we talk about this kind of stuff all the time on this podcast, and we try to be, you know, a responsible source of entertainment for you folks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I just think that it's always important to mention to be careful with the media that you consume. And mm-hmm. also, like, the reason why it's so important to be careful with stuff like this is because this affects real people and real people's stories and the survivors of those people and et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And so, just like Kyle said, just please keep that in mind. Have a little bit of media literacy about you and just filter the bullshit, you know?
Mm-hmm. To finish off this video, the author claims in one photo that Xena from the Trek is talking on a smartphone and also posts about other various future technology that they shouldn't have had access to at the time. The author says that this proves that they were a very special group, uniquely selected for a special mission to test out new weapons. And this is where the radiation comes from. It comes from UFOs. In the photo where Xena has sugar cubes in her palm, the author says that she is feeding an invisible elf. The elf was either invisible or they tampered with the negative, or the group was especially instructed to keep the elf out of the picture. In this photo, there is a creature crawling out of the woods and a UFO flying in the sky.
I feel like we can't just gloss over the fact that you just said invisible elf.
Yeah.
This person who made this video is like,
they were killed to hide the invisible elves. Duh.
On Death Mountain, huh?
Mm-hmm.
In Siberia?
Mm-hmm.
This would be the place to do it, would it not be? He might be onto something. Who knows?
Another theory started to become very popular after people started comparing the Dyatlov Pass incident and the Chervoy Pass incident. One narrative that was put forward by residents of the area introduced the disease Merechesny as a possible cause of the strange behaviors of the hiker, which included symptoms like disorientation, a loss of the track of time, not feeling cold, and walking in a trance. These are all also symptoms of hypothermia.
Right.
Another symptom of this illness is aggression and atypical behavior for the person in general. The Sami people call it Merechini. The Eskimo name for it is the call of the North Star. Those who become under the spell of this phenomena begin having both visual and auditory hallucinations and exhibit very strange behavior, such as shedding their clothes and inexplicably walking northward. Another word for it is Piblatok. And these are all different local names for what is commonly known as Arctic hysteria. The problem with this theory is that has been only observed in native peoples. Non-native peoples often observe and report it, but they have never been afflicted by it. They see it so often that some speculate that the natives are throwing a tantrum because of the invasion of strange people in their lands. Again, this is obviously a very racist and colonial interpretation of the phenomena.
Of their behavior, right?
Yeah. And again, because this is something that really only afflicts native peoples, I would confidently say that they were not affected by Arctic hysteria.
No, it doesn't seem like it.
No. And this is where we're going to leave you for this week. We've covered quite a few different theories. I think there might be some grains of truth in some of the things we've talked about this week. I think the infrasound is interesting. I think the gravity well definitely has some merit behind it, for sure.
I don't know. I would say that the one that really, really got me the most was the gravity fluctuation. That one's got to be the most accurate, the most truthful, the most well-researched. Very much how what was it in spontaneous human combustion that dude had discovered?
Fucking.
It was like a pyro microorganism or something.
Yeah. The. Anyway. Oh, fuck. What were those things called? Pyrotons.
Pyrotons. Let's go. It's just like discovering pyrotons when you're researching SHC.
Exactly.
Oh my god.
I wanted to get some of the weirder stuff out of the way this week. We're going to be a bit more grounded next week. I think we're going to get to some more truth. We're not going to answer the question. I'm sorry. Spoiler alert. But I think we'll get to something that I think explains a good chunk of what happened.
Yeah. Let me be very clear that I don't actually believe in the gravity fluctuation. And let me also be very clear that I do think that the katabatic wind theory is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that infrasound is really interesting too. Because again, the thing that I latch onto in this case, without getting into a backassward stance, but the thing that I latch onto in this case is the tent being cut from the inside. And I'm really, really wondering if there is a theory that explains everything, because it's the tent being cut from the inside and the radiation for me that really, really keeps me up at night about this.
We're on the exact same page.
I'm so glad that I get to do this show with you, my friend.
Me too, Arden. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast, everybody.
Thank you so very much. It means so much that we can break up our Casey Anthony and our Dyatlov series, and you folks are still here, and we really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. You can subscribe and review if you're enjoying the show, and if you think someone else will enjoy the show, please share it with them.
Because word of mouth is the best way to spread that the Backasswards podcast has finally, and I mean finally, talked about gravity fluctuation.
We made it.
You know. That your favorite podcast also talks about real life scientific phenomenons that happen all around us.
You can listen to our previous episodes for more. I would recommend our episode on Aleister Crowley.
Whoa. Our Aleister Crowley series was awesome. That was when Alec was on the show. Alec was always fun to have on the show. And also, Kyle did such an amazing job telling the Aleister Crowley saga. Oh my god, that man.
What a saga it is.
He was into some diabolical shit, I'll tell you that right now. It's not really a lollipop episode, but like, for real, content warning on those episodes. It's just a lot. That's all. Yeah. It's fun. Don't worry, but it's a lot. But it's fun, but it's a lot.
But it's fun.
But it is very fun. Should have ended with that one.
You can follow me and Arden on Twitter. I am at BackassWordKyle. Arden is at Arden_Smith. And you can follow the podcast on all of your favorite social media. On Twitter, at BackassWordsPod. On Instagram, BackassWordsPod. TikTok, BackassPod. Facebook, search the BackassWords Podcast. And on YouTube, just search the BackassWords Podcast. That's right. All credit goes to Arden right now. Arden started getting us up on YouTube with our backlog. So starting with episode 1, we just got episode 12.
Yes, we're all the way to up Amityville. Today.
So we're up to the Amityville Horror. We're going to start really getting those up on YouTube for you guys. And hopefully, once we're caught up, we'll start getting some video.
Hey, hopefully, yes. For you guys. That's kind of what we're hoping for. It's an exciting time here at the Backasswards Podcast. We've got a lot of other projects in the work too, in addition to the Wednesday phenomena and in addition to the Patreon. Mm-hmm. So it's just a cool time to be here, to be a part of the audience, to be helping us create the content. We're doing a lot of really cool stuff. I highly recommend that you join us everywhere. And hopefully we have a video medium coming for you very, very soon. That's what we're hoping for.
Speaking of joining us everywhere, join us over at Patreon, patreon.com/backasspod. We got 2 tiers. You can just support us for $1 a month if you want to hop into our Discord and get a shout out on the podcast. Or you can join us at $5 a month at our Manchurian Candidate tier and get access to our bonus weekly show, The Wednesday Phenomena.
When they've been nominated. It's so much fun.
It's so much
fun.
I'm Kyle.
I'm Arden.
And we will see you guys next week, unless you're on a hike and you just happen to wander into a little pocket on this flat, hollow earth that we live on.
Dude.
Where gravity is weaker. Well, not gravity, where the force of the earth moving through the empty nothingness at
10 meters per second squared
actually is less than that. And so your body explodes and breaks your bones so that you can stay safe.
Yes, and when your bones are being broken, just remember that they are being flung approximately 1 to 1.5 kilometers away so that you could stay weird.
That man was a doctor. He had a doctorate, dude. He had a PhD. Convinced.
He was so lost in his own sauce. I loved it. I think it's the most real theory, but not really. We'll see you next week. The danger is real.
Danger is real.
People say that gravitational fucking shit like that exists. Oh my God.
We'll see you guys next week.
Can't with you, dude. I can't.
I'm just so you can see it on the thing.
I know, like, oh, that's I know. I'm just looking at you. I'm sorry.
Oh, also I need to switch my windows up. Jesus Christ. Fucking, I should have done this 20 minutes ago, dude.
Okay,
dude, all right, there we go.
If this is the soundbite, to provide a little context, Kyle makes these funny faces at me while we're silent.
Nothing.
Whatever, dude. You're a liar. You're lying to me and to the audience, because this is definitely
swear to God, this time I was doing nothing. I won't say anything about last time.
Now you're making me look like an asshole in front of the audience, Kyle.
I'm making something. Now you're just calling my face weird.
dude. I didn't mean it like that. I thought you were making funny faces at me.
There is this. That's it. That is the soundbite. There you go.
All right.